is Yael Friedman, who teaches at the Film at the University of Portsmouth.
Yes.
And then we have Leila, who I don't need to introduce because you have already met her, I would say. But it is a real pleasure to have you here, Leila. Thank you. And then up there is Rivka Berland, who is writing a PhD at the NYU on the politics of tourism development in the West Bank, so very topical, but she's also working for, as a senior campaigner, for War on Want. I'm very happy that you're all here. Now, what we want to do is the following. We will be chatting for about 30 minutes here between us, but that doesn't mean that you don't get your say too. 30 minutes in, I have a watch here, 30 minutes in, it's all you. And so if you have questions, you remember them, because then we'll have all of 30 minutes to chat, ask questions, and have a nice discussion. Okay, just to outline what we're going to talk about just a little bit is, at first we would like just to talk about the bigger picture a little bit of the film, of the situation, and then slightly more specifically talk about the film. And of course, the question, as you know, the title, the question of tourism and politics and politicized tourism is central to this evening, as it is to the film. So that will be one of the biggest topics. Okay, Rivka, why don't you start?
Great, thank you very much. Can you hear me in the back there? Is the volume okay for everybody? Great, okay. So first, thank you very much for having me, and it's a real honor and pleasure to be a part of this event, and especially an honor to be with the filmmaker who brought this wonderful film to us. I want to start just in very broad terms to reflect a little bit on the film and something that's really unique, I think, about what the film brings to us, and also what the project, the Open Bethlehem Project, brings to us is an opportunity to see these concepts and these things together, tourism and colonialism or military occupation. And it's really unique because those are two things that we don't often think of together, and there's a lot that's illuminated by thinking of those things together. So tourism, for example, we've said already, usually we think of it in a sort of depoliticized realm, or that's at least how it's spoken about usually. But when we look at tourism in the context of military occupation, we see a whole different piece of what it means to be a part of tourism. So we see elements of the production of tourism and how difficult that is when you're kind of working up against occupation. We see things about the experience of touring, and the very political experience of touring and being toured also for the Palestinians who are sometimes stuck in their towns behind the wall. So tourism takes on a very different tone when we see it in this context, and I think the film brings that to us really nicely. But similarly, when we talk about Palestine and we talk about military occupation and colonialism, the images that we have usually are the images of sort of military violence, of soldiers with guns, of kind of physical contact. And I think when we bring tourism into that picture, we see a different piece of what occupation means, sort of the banal structural violence of military occupation. So it's not just the soldier with the gun, it's also the kind of destruction of cultural heritage and the sort of grading down on the people who bring that cultural heritage to life and who make it dynamic. And also the sort of attempt to destroy the Palestinian tourism industry, which is a historic industry, and under other circumstances would be a really important backbone of a Palestinian society. So we see how the occupation is not just these kind of military moments, it's also this bigger picture, and I think that's a really powerful gift that the film brings to us. I'll just say something very brief about the sort of history of tourism in Palestine and some of the sort of structures. So currently, around 2 million people visit the West Bank every year. And the vast majority of those people are Christian pilgrims. And these Christian pilgrims are following in a long tradition, of a centuries-old tradition of Christian pilgrims traveling to Palestine, but also Muslim pilgrims traveling to Palestine for pilgrimages, and to a lesser extent Jewish also. So there's a very long history of pilgrimage to Palestine, and Palestinians have always been a part of making that possible for people to come visit. So running lodges, making souvenirs, the handicrafts, acting as translators, as tour guides. So as early as the 16th century, there's records of Palestinian tour guide guilds in Jerusalem. So it's a very long and very rooted industry, and that began to change and to really be kind of broken apart a little bit when the colonization of Palestine and the Zionist colonization began in the late 19th century. So already by the 1930s, this is before the State of Israel was established, but there was a heavy Zionist presence there already, the Zionist organizations saw that Palestinians were actually using their roles in tourism as a way to talk to people about what was happening and about why they were nervous and opposed to Zionism. So the Zionist organizations actually created tourism industries, Zionist tourism agencies, to counteract the Palestinian narrative and also to push Palestinians out of the industry. That's even before the State of Israel was established. And then in 1948, when the State of Israel was established and the Nakba created the Palestinian refugee crisis, when the majority of Palestinians became refugees, it sort of crystallized those actions, and that those Zionist tourism agencies became the State of Israel's tourism industry, which we see now. So if we zoomed ahead, just to finish up a bit, if we zoom ahead to look at the situation now, the State of Israel continues to use tourism as a way to whitewash the occupation. And actually, just in the recent weeks, there's been news reports about the gay pride parades in Tel Aviv, which you might have seen a little bit. And there was an amazing, actually, sort of counter-narrative put out by Palestinian organizations and some sort of left Israeli organizations saying, please don't come here for pride. We don't take pride in occupation. So there's a very kind of interesting dynamic there, but the State of Israel is really heavily investing in tourism as a way to promote a narrative, but also as a way to continue colonizing Palestinian land. So in the West Bank, every single Israeli settlement has a tourism committee, and one of the ways that the West Bank settlements continue to expand is by using the guise of tourism, saying, okay, well, maybe we're not going to build new houses on that Palestinian land, but we'd like to set that up as a nature reserve. And so they're able to get state funding to do that and to use tourism as a way to keep Palestinians off their land and to continue the expansion. So I think that's an important context to have when we think about, when we see the film and think about sort of what Palestinians are up against in the tourism industry.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Rivka. That, I think, nicely relates to a question that I want to ask Yael about the question, the connection to the land that exists in the Israeli narrative.
I'll just hand over. I think leading on from what you were saying, I think to understand a wider picture, one of the things that we need to understand is how the land tourism function within the Zionist narrative. So it's not only within relation, you know, it's beyond the kind of military occupation that we see in the West Bank, but it goes way back, as you said, to the kind of war of narratives between the Palestinian and the, but it's also very internal to the Zionist project. Because what the Zionist project needed to establish is a connection between the new coming Jews and the land. He needed to construct that. And one very central way of constructing that was connecting and constructing those narratives of relationship to the land in many ways. And it had a very, very physical manifestation. First of all, in the promotion all the time of what they call in Hebrew, Yediat Haaretz, which is kind of knowing the land. It's that notion of knowing the land physically, viscerally, through walking in nature. Okay, so that's a huge kind of project of Zionism, of getting the Israeli population to walk the land, to go to trips, to visit heritage sites. And there's a massive investment. I mean, it started before the 48, but within the 48 territories, which, at least in the mind of the world and the mind of Israel, were legitimate Israel, right after the war, there's a huge investment of the state. But huge, if you consider that this is a new country with not a lot of resources, the resources that were put into changing the landscape, reshaping heritage sites, writing new narratives for them, renaming them, and sort of excavations, if you like, of archaeological sites. And again, all of that is used to sort of justify for the Israelis themselves. It's part of the nation-building mission. It's part of shaping a new Israeli identity, which didn't exist before. So all that was very much produced through tourism. And the kind of reshaping of the narrative that drives it is to establish this link between the new Israelis, modern Israel, and that ancient land of Israel 2,000 years ago, leaping, bridging over 2,000 years of diasporic experience of Jews, which were completely negated and written off the narrative in the same way that the Palestinians of narrative, or the modern history of Palestine, was written out. So what you get is a kind of a landscape of tourism which either relates to Christianity, in the same way that you see in Bethlehem after 67, or to sort of ancient Roman times, pilgrimage that has to do with that. So in fact, in Israel in the first few decades, quite a lot of the sites of the heritage were of Christian importance, and that's what and all the modern history of the region is erased. And again, it's got a very, very physical manifestation in the way in which you tour the landscape. So a lot of the relics of Palestinian houses that were there were left unnamed and sort of dotted around the landscape, and people tour them and picnic there, and nobody ever asks, what's that a relic of? We never ask as children touring through that. And another alternative sort of narrative was constructed around all these heritage sites and excavations. So I don't know how many people know sort of Israel, but take something like Masada, which is perhaps the most overt example. These are archaeological excavations with a very political aim. They're seeking to refind all these particular selective stories in the heritage of the Jews at that time, or the biblical times, that are around national identity and national revolt. So Masada is around that, it's national revolt of the Romans. So it's not Jewish in that sense, in that religious sense. It's more about, in the kind of national sense, and it's more about fighting for one land. So it's those kind of narratives. So that's the context of it. Yes, that's
I think it's now time that we talk about the film, because we have all travelled with Laila in the last hour and a half. She has taken us to her hometown, she has taken us to Bethlehem. Some of you might have been, some of you have not been. Those of you been have their own memories, and yet you come back to this place through the eyes of Laila. So if you want to talk a little bit just about the film as a tour, maybe, or its forms.
Yeah, just as we spoke actually behind the scenes before coming here, my attention was drawn to the fact that, I actually grew up in a tourist town predominantly, and I never liked the tourism industry. I used to think I hated my town because it's a tourist town. But you drew my attention to the fact that effectively, I have become, even with this tour, with the film, a kind of a tour guide. And it is true that there's different ways of actually presenting material that is for tourists and actually sharing an experience with people or inviting people to visit. And I think I definitely have become maybe an alternative tour guide, as I probably realized that my town has been shut out from the world. It's very, very difficult in the kind of power struggle that exists today. Bethlehem is basically a backyard of Israel. Israel controls the borders, controls the marketplace abroad, controls who comes in and out. And so it becomes a big responsibility or a challenge for us to actually almost take our town abroad to showcase it to people, to invite people to see it. And maybe it is what I'm doing in a really alternative way, which is taking Bethlehem, putting it on the screen and touring with it. But it is, at the same time, obviously a desire to make people engage with it, because, you know, the film is not called Open Bethlehem accidentally. It is about, we want to open Bethlehem, we want the place that, you know, although I have, as I said, I grew up in a place that was a tourist town and I felt fed up with it. But when I was experiencing the building of the wall and Bethlehem becoming more and more isolated, I actually wish that it is just that little tourist town that it was. And I experienced that part of Bethlehem's history as a very positive history, and one that I would very much like to see maybe reinvented and reinvigorated. Of course, I'm very conscious that Bethlehem had a whole history of tourists, as you all said. And the tourism and the nature of tourism always depended on the powers of this world and how the powers lay, including actually up to the, for example, one of the realizations that I was very surprised by was that until about the 17th century, pilgrimage to the Nativity Church by regional Muslims was extremely, extremely high. There was scores of Muslims visiting the church. But the Ottomans did not like that because it did not correspond to their brand of Islam. Yeah. And so they worked a lot to curtail that kind of investment in the church by local Muslims. So I suppose every subsequent ruler or, you know, power comes with its own things to the table. And for us, as people of this town, the challenge will remain, well, how do we take that into our hands? How do we take the telling of the story, of our own story? How do we become the guides of the explorers who come to explore our town and not give that voice to just anybody who has actually sheer power to take that exploration into their hand? So I think that's maybe something that I think about a lot all the time and naturally, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Before we've been talking a little bit about questions about what does it mean to produce culture under an occupation? And for me personally, in my work, I think as of Palestinian literature, Palestinian film, and so forth, as a form of cultural resistance, telling the story, telling the unheard story. Yeah, you as a film scholar, could you give us a little bit more about that, maybe?
I think it's what you said. I think for me, if I go back to your film, it's one of these films that is so... It acts as a document, in because it takes us through time, and because we've got... And I think if you think about this thing in cinema, as you said, historically, you know, starting from the 70s under the PLF, you know, film units at the time, it's this accumulative record which allows to tell the story. And I think the culture had a lot to do with that, the cultural production of Palestinian cultural production had a lot to do with it, because if we think 30 years back to, you know, how dominant the Zionist narrative was in the world stage and where we are today, I mean, this event would have not happened 30 years ago. It just wouldn't. There weren't the sort of voices to be heard, but also it wasn't allowed to be heard. And I think it is exactly that form of resistance which managed to sort of overrun. So at least we have some achievements.
Yeah. I think actually, just to respond, it's a very interesting way of looking at it as well, because I was very conscious when I was working on the film that I wanted to create a document, because I have witnessed several big upheavals in Palestine that had no documentation. And that really stayed with me, and I felt that I do not want something like building a wall in Bethlehem and changing the face of the town to go unrecorded. At the same time, I think I faced maybe the same dilemma that a lot of people working with digital media face today. So for example, I know now that I have a big Bethlehem archive and not know what to do with it, or debating what to do with it. What archivists face in that you can create a very smart, good archive, which is a document, but nobody goes there. You know, it sits, you know, on a website, and hardly anybody, maybe a scholar once every 100 years, might go in and just decide to explore one aspect or another. So for me, that was no good. And this is why there was the challenge of creating a document that also can be presented to the public and that the public can interact with. And I think maybe that is one of the challenges I faced with the film, because I wanted to make sure that it's not just a document, it's also something that the public can interact with.
And I think part of the vehicle for you, which again is quite popular in a lot of the films that come out of the region at the moment, Israeli and Palestinians, is that it's carried by your own personal story.
Mm.
And I wondered how much that played in your sort of decision making at some point. Did you always knew you were going to be at the centre of it, that you were going to drive the story? Or?
Well, no. Strangely enough, I initially started looking for a story that I can follow. I knew that to document the building of the wall, I will need, you know, a plausible story that I can also follow, or a story that could serve as a vehicle to look at the town. And I tried different things. Like, for example, I spent some time at Bethlehem TV station trying to see if I could kind of make the film from there, you know. I think the problem was that I felt from talking to different people, and the war was already kind of, you know, about to get started, I got a sense that I might not be able to persuade people to be very patient with me to run such a long course, and I couldn't find somebody I could totally put my hand on my heart and think, they're going to run the course with me, and it's going to be a long story, I don't know how long, you know. Well, I thought a year, but could be a bit longer, you know. And in the end, somehow I thought, well, I'm going to have to make it about the whole town, but maybe I can inject some personal touch to it. And it's just that when I stayed on and on and on, and my whole story changed, the story brewed beyond what I thought it will do. And then 5 years on, I recognized that I do have a story, and the story is completely different to what I initially thought or planned. And I had to go back to try and, maybe some people think it's all kind of there from the start, but actually I had to work quite a lot to retrace the steps and try and make sure that I can tell my story properly. So.
Thank you. You were talking about telling stories and telling people's stories. Rivka, if I can ask you, there have been a lot more tours organized by Palestinians to Palestine. If you could also in a way to tell the story. Could you talk a little bit about Palestinian organized tourism?
Yeah, definitely. For me, actually, one of the most inspiring examples of that I have encountered is actually not intended for external audiences, but is Palestinian tours that are designed for other Palestinians. So in the West Bank, inviting Palestinians from 48 Palestine to come and visit and going on hikes together in the land, or even from just within the West Bank. I mean, I think we saw really, really exactly in the film how the wall and the effects of the Israeli closures isolate people. So even though the West Bank is a tiny, tiny area, especially after the Second Intifada, a lot of people didn't leave their villages or their cities, sometimes because they weren't allowed, but when that happens for so long, people get out of the habit of doing so. So there's some really beautiful efforts right now, actually, of Palestinians saying, well, actually, we need to keep kind of walking our lands and getting to know our lands and making sure that we're not only speaking to outside, but also speaking to each other. So that's one really inspiring and beautiful example. But I think that, a lot of people have really taken on that idea of the stakes of having the narrative, and that the narrative that goes along with tourism is a way of sort of keeping the Palestinian story dynamic, but also continuing to connect with people abroad. And there's, of course, a long history of international solidarity with Palestinians, especially from the kind of high days of the PLO, and a lot of that work was oriented towards keeping the connection with the sort of international left, especially. So I think there's a sort of wave of new projects from Palestinians in the West Bank, inside 48 Palestine, in Gaza, and also Palestinians in exile in the diaspora, who are creating ways, even if it's not specific physical tours, but ways of thinking about travel and thinking about place and identity, and using especially culture as a way to talk about that and to invite the conversation in, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, it's precisely, I mean, I don't know what else to add, but it is very encouraging when there is interaction between Palestinian cities, because obviously they are also kept apart. And most recently I've started seeing more schools, for example, from Jenin, from Nablus, from Hebron, coming to Bethlehem. And it's always a very nice experience to see them. And I think, I particularly found nice experiences having, like, because I filmed a lot in the church, and I've had seen different people, groups from different schools come through. Of course, the girls tend to very much like that I'm filming and bossing a group of men around that tends to be there. It's not about the church, it's about that. And I hear from Janine, they want to move to Bethlehem immediately. Yeah. So that's another aspect of tourism. Yeah. But, yeah.
Let me look. We have a few more minutes. So since we've just started to laughing, I noticed I was sitting in the back. I noticed that a lot of you started laughing when the picture of the Pope was cut out. And even though there is a lot of pain in this film, I think there's also quite a bit of humor. And sometimes it's the humor of we laugh because we have to laugh. It's a way of survival. But there's also other elements. Was that intentional?
Of course. Well, I mean, you know, in a way, I actually think that Palestinians are quite humorous culture. I don't know whether people think that or don't, or whether they know it or not, don't, but they are. And, life is about, obviously, the whole thing. I mean, the kind of jokes people tell in the worst of circumstances in Palestine is always heartening and always, like everybody else, like every other culture, you laugh through the absurdities that come your way. And I think this is, in a film of that length, you have to kind of have all aspects of life. you have to show the good and the bad. And I wanted to show my town as I like it, my town as I feel sad for it, my time when it's happy and laughs, when it's humorous, when it's sad, and I think there's no other way of making a story full and real other than doing all these things, And also my car really was giving me a hard time. And that was genuine. And in the end it became the butt of a joke for everyone, for me too,
Last question for you, Laila. You mentioned an archive before, and before we came in, as you all know, Dara was chatting. She mentioned a future for the project and a future for visiting Bethlehem in other ways, I guess.
Yeah.
If you want to talk about that just a little bit, that'd be great.
Yeah. So when I first started making the film, everybody was telling me, Bethlehem is the most documented town in the world. It's the most photographed place in the world. So I was quite comfortable then that I thought that I would find all the materials I would need in Bethlehem. So I started looking for any archives that we have in the city, and I found that we had hardly any. So for the sake of the film, I started looking for archives, and I looked every possible archive, library, every possible library, museum. But over years, especially after my fifth year of being stuck in Bethlehem, that quest became an obsession. And I managed to, over the course of 10 years, I managed to gather one of the largest visual archives of Bethlehem. And I'm currently working with a British historian and with the University of Sussex to turn that into like an online portal, an interactive portal that could allow people to explore Bethlehem in a very different way, both virtually and also physically when they go. So to offer it a completely, to offer both an archive but also a different visiting experience for visitors. Having said that, I'm very, very keen on this project. I still very much encourage people to visit Bethlehem for real, because this is a way that you can help us keep our city connected with the outside world. And I'm very pleased, in fact, that today we have one of my very good friends, Linda Ramsden, who has run tours to Bethlehem and to Palestine for many years. And she does a wonderful job in bringing so many people, not for half an hour and an hour, and not just to be told that this is where Christ was born, but to have a really full, interesting experience of the place. And she is here, so she's given me some of her leaflets that have information about her coming tours, and you're very welcome to pick up some from me or from her. And if I'm in Bethlehem when you visit, I will be very happy to
tour you around.
Well, I think that opens the floor very much. You know, you didn't only say the word interactive, you also mentioned the first person in the audience. Yes, you. Whether you'd be interested to say something too, or anyone else, any questions, any suggestion, lots of hands are up. Excellent. Here's the first one.
Fantastic effort in producing that movie. We greatly enjoyed it. Just something that I crossed my mind was, is there an opportunity, or did the UNESCO show any interest at all in your project? Because that's one of the things that I think could be, because it's such an important sort of heritage site, of course, goes back thousands of years. And of course, the other thing is about the status of Bethlehem as an international city. I don't know whether there was any thought or effort on that front.
Thanks for the question. I think that maybe the bottom line of all these things, unfortunately, and what one learns, is who holds power. So for example, yes, Bethlehem is a heritage site. But for years and years, we fought to try and put it, to have it accepted by the UNESCO as an international protected heritage site. And it was impossible. Why was it impossible? Because only states, recognized states, can apply to protect their cities. And we asked for an exception, but it was not possible. So Liverpool is a protected heritage site. But Bethlehem wasn't, you know. Until very, very recently, in 2012, I think, when Palestine was accepted by the majority of member states as a state, that it was allowed to become a member of the UNESCO. And Bethlehem was accepted as a heritage site. The next problem that we face is that, what does it mean to be a heritage site? Well, you need to develop it, you need to maintain it, and for that you need international crews, big budgets, a real central government that is able to constantly engage and manage the site. And this is what Palestinians are not allowed to have. So we are now listed formally as a heritage site, but the challenge of really running it properly as a heritage site to protect it remains really elusive. So that is the problem, that because we don't control our borders, we don't control the way goods go in and out, people go in and out, expertise goes in and out. It's very, very, very challenging to do this, to maintain this operation. That's a problem.
Yes, here.
Thank you. Yes, I'd really like to emphasize the fact that Bethlehem needs us. Bethlehem needs everybody in this room to go there. When I was, I'm the person that Leila was referring to. I take people on political study tours to really learn about the reality and engage with the people. And even when I was there at Easter, the hotels, some of them were quite empty. Very, very, very few people there. Bethlehem will die unless internationals go and say they're not afraid to go there. They will go. You can be given guidance on how to get in, and you meet the people, and they all say, go back and tell our stories. It'll be an incredible, life-changing experience for you to do something like that. So support Leila and the message of the film to keep Bethlehem open.
Thank you. I see an hand up there.
Hello. My name's Imogen, and I'm an artist and drawer and printmaker. And some of my work focuses on Palestine, particularly in Hebron. From my experience of travelling to Palestine a couple of times and working with the community in Hebron, and one of the things I really love and feel very close to Palestine about is, because we've been talking a lot about Palestinian narrative, but from my experience, actually the Palestinian narrative is one narrative. What I really love about it is it's so complex and it's this real multiplicity of narratives. And from some of my experience, that some of those narratives are conflicting. And you know, I've met young sort of campaigners who are doing amazing things to pull their community together and to pull youth groups together. And then I've also met young guys who just want to get out of there. And I kind of wondered that, you know, in terms of filmmaking or the arts in general, how do you think that these kind of forms can actually not only communicate the situation, but actually start to unpick and unfold our understanding and broaden our understanding of these multiplicity of different narratives and what is that place and what is happening?
Yeah, thank you for the question. Of course, so, I mean, as any people and any culture, the Palestinian culture, the Palestinian people are complex and obviously have multiple identities, have multiple stories, have multiple aspirations. But it is nevertheless important kind of not to forget about the difference between also individual narratives, if you wish, and the collective narrative. Because within collective narratives, you sometimes can trace the big themes, the big important things for a whole people. So, I mean, a Palestinian might want to leave, but they will still remember what the occupation did to their town. Or they might want to stay, they might want to become a pilot or a politician or a waiter, but still the massive, big meta-narratives, they inform a nation, they're not the same as the multiplicity of narratives necessarily. They do have a different, if you wish, status as well as role within a psyche of a people. So, and I think that applies to Israelis as well as Palestinians, that people have to shape, because, you know, moving together into like a space that shapes your political project, that your kind of the space where you live, how you inhabit it, how you participate in social life and in the political project, is shaped by these meta-narratives, how we come together to do something, where we're heading together. And I think, particularly at times of crisis, these narratives are in fact more similar in a nation than that they are apart. Like in America today, you might have what looks like completely competing two Americas. But in Palestine, in that sense, I would say there isn't that many narratives.
I think I just want to add something about it. I think Israeli and Palestinian society in some ways are very similar like that because, and it is a product of the conflict, the need to maintain a collective narrative, the need to maintain a collective identity is central for that conflict to continue. So to answer your question, I think that actually if we look at Palestinian cinema, certainly since the late 80s onward, it actually has a very, very rich tapestry of voices. So all these experiences that you talk about, and a lot of it is around individual narratives, as I said. So, but I think the tension between the need to confirm to a collective identity, because you need to maintain it. From an Israeli point of view, you know, I think most of us here don't agree with it, but it is, you know, I know these really frame of mine, it works very similar to that. Yeah. I'm not saying it's equal.
What I was going to say that I totally agree, but I would say, obviously, from an Israeli point of view, I think the identity and the narrative is important for the conflict to continue.
Yes.
But for the Palestinian side, the narrative is important so that
we can overcome
the problem. Yes.
But it is. It has to be said. It's not that, but in Israeli society, there are competing narratives as well.
Yeah.
They're not. We're not in the majority, unfortunately. But
yeah.
I just want to add, as a literary scholar, read lots and lots and lots of fiction. Lots of memoirs have come out, especially English-speaking Palestinian authors, a lot of British, a lot of American, have been publishing since, I'd say, the last 10, 15 years. So I think when people got fed up with the Intifada and saw that the guns don't necessarily help the situation, a lot more memoirs, texts, stories were being told. Again, we have the collective story and we have the individual stories. You have a question?
So I was just in Bethlehem about 2 weeks ago, and it was surprising for me to see a lot of religious tourists who would maybe actually stay a little bit more than a few hours, maybe even spend the night. But the few people that I met were from Bulgaria, Eastern Europe. They had zero idea what Palestine is. They didn't know they were inside of it. The next stop was to go to Sinai, and from there to Cairo to fly out, and they flew in through Tel Aviv. And you know, they have passports that allow them to move in a geography that Palestinians. So being there with those privileges is actually not really enough to understand the struggle, or to really actually develop, I think, sympathy for it. To go back home and actually join a campaign or do something. You'll go back to work to your 9-to-5, and your religious holiday is over. So I think, you know, the over-optimism, I mean, I'm from Egypt, a country that has been kind of ravaged by tourism. Mm. You know, tourism and colonialism, they're actually not separate. And, you know, the idea of tourism as sort of the way out, I'm not so optimistic about that. So I'm just wondering if perhaps the solution is not to buy time by allowing some more people to go there and buy more wooden Jesus heads on the way out of the church, but actually to just fight colonialism, to actually just fight the occupation, and then that might be a byproduct of the coming later.
Yeah. Thanks. Sorry, is that okay? I answer? Yeah. I think the fact that the panel discussion today is framed as in like politicizing tourism doesn't mean that we all think that tourism is the magical answer. Yeah, so we don't. I don't, for sure, you know. But what I'd say is that, you know, when you're not walking in the shoes of the powerful, meaning you don't have huge powerful allies, and that the wealth of this world, the the arms industry, the oil industry are not in your pocket, you have to think of alternative ways of creating centers of power. And unfortunately, in our case, we are almost, condemned to only think about soft power. And soft power means that we need to seriously go to all the political establishments, lobby them successfully, to make them change policy and positions, you know, with regard to us. But what are the weapons in our arsenal that we go to these establishments to ask them to help us? Unfortunately, it is their sense of value, it's their value system, it's their ability to feel for us, for real, as people. And unfortunately, time and again, we realize that to go to people and ask them to lobby for us, to do something right for us, to do what their hearts are telling them is right, does not happen unless they visit. It's almost very difficult to make people change their minds or invest in us or feel for us unless they see it with their own eyes, because it is so absurd and unthinkable that, I mean, anybody who's decent just cannot really just then walk away and think life is the same. So although I personally divide people quite strongly into and nations even, you know, as much as maybe that would sound politically incorrect, but being half Russian, maybe I'm allowed that license, you know. that there are countries that are just not political, where huge swathes of the population have not been politicized. So you're talking about Bulgarians or Russians, they're not political in their own country, let alone on behalf of some other nation. So unfortunately, yeah, that's a challenge, but the we are committed to working with people who maybe are politicized and political in their countries and can move things. And maybe we need to be, unfortunately, also strategic in not spending a lot of time with Russians and Bulgarians, and spending more time with Americans or Europeans, you know. Unfortunately, that's the case, you know.
Yeah, you say.
I think it's a really important question and issue to bring up. And there's been some, productive conversation and recognition of this, that in some ways visiting is a very powerful thing, but it really depends on the kind of political movements that people are involved in more broadly, both in Palestine, but also here. So there has been, I think, an upsurge recently of people saying, okay, my visit to Palestine is gonna be not just kind of a tour, but a political delegation to meet my counterparts. So there's a group called Librarians and Archivists for Palestine, and they travel to Palestine and meet librarians and archivists there and talk about how they can do political work together. And I think those kinds of things start to get at some of that question that it's kind of not enough to just visit, and also it matters kind of what you're doing when you get back, if you're visiting, that it's kind of not enough to go and feel like you've kind of done your duty, so to speak. And I think there is a problem with that. I think a lot of people do that. The other thing I just wanted to say from my research, one of the other inspiring things that I looked at is during the first Intifada, during the first Palestinian uprising, there were really powerful general strikes, and sometimes they were boycotts of the Israeli-sponsored tourism activities. So during that time, the occupation army completely controlled Christmas in Bethlehem, and it was run by the Israeli military. And one of the things that Palestinians in Bethlehem and other places did is said, actually, we're not going to participate in this. And so what's going to happen is all these tourists are coming from abroad, and actually there are no Palestinians that are going to go out to celebrate Christmas and say, we're not going to give our name to this kind of normalization. So I think actually that a history or a conversation about boycotts is also an important part of the history of tourism, being strategic with tourism. Sometimes it's strategic not to do it. And I think thinking about the region more broadly, I think that's a very interesting history to track, to see what kinds of things that can bring up.